From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Oh, hi. Thank heaven you're here. You look absolutely terrific, honestly. Mother wanted me to come out in a kimono, so we had quite a fight. The best kind of clothes for a protest pose is this ensemble of pantyhose put over the shorts worn under the skirt that doubles as a cape. To reveal you in capri pants, you fashion out of ski pants in a jersey knit designed to fit the contour of your shape. Then cinch it with the cord from the drape. And that's the revolutionary costume for today, to show the polo riders in khakis and topsiders just what a revolutionary costume has to say. It can't be ordered from L.L. Bean. There's more to living than Kelly Green. And that's the revolution I mean. Da-da-da-da-da.
In 1975, the Maisels brothers filmed a documentary about two of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis's most eccentric relatives, her aunt and cousin Edith and Edie Bouvier Beale. Since then, Grey Gardens has become something of a cult classic, and now it's inspired a Broadway musical. Joining me now are Christine Ebersole, who plays both Edith and her daughter Edie, and Scott Frankel, who composed the score. I'm very pleased to welcome them to my show. Hello.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Thanks.
Christine, as I said, you play both little and big Edie. Do you see similarities between the two of them?
They both love music. They're both artistic. They enjoy each other, and they're both highly intelligent women, and they're both beautiful women, so they do have a lot in common, but particularly the music.
Well, you play one in the first act and one in the second act. Does it require psychological transformation during the intermission?
Well, I think a lot of times, actually, just something as simple as taking off makeup and putting on new makeup helps center you and get you into the character.
Now, you know, a lot of actors have told me that the costume is mm-hmm. a major part in becoming the character.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But the rest of us would never imagine that. We
no.
always think that it all has to do with trying to channel somebody.
Well, there are certain things that can inform you and help you get into the spacesuit you need to get into, and I think costume and makeup really does help.
Scott, whose idea was it to bring Grey Gardens to the stage?
It was actually mine. I had been a tremendous fan of the documentary for many years, but it never, ever occurred to me that it could be adapted into a stage musical. I believe it's actually the first time a documentary has been used as source material. And then
I would have thought a straight play first.
Well, I mean, yes. The reason it kind of occurred to me was that they were both such performers and exhibitionists, both the mother, Big Edith, and the daughter, Little Edie. The mother, particularly in her youth, had a beautiful, gleaming soprano, and she used to like to sing parlor songs in her living room and elsewhere. And the daughter always fancied herself a great dancer. So I thought that since they were both such incredible performers and had that kind of public energy, that might serve as a way into the project.
There was an article in the New York Times that described an encounter you had with a devoted fan of the documentary who was upset that you were doing a musical.
You know, I acquired the rights in 2002, but we really didn't start writing in earnest till 2004. But in the interim, I used to spend every summer on Cape Cod, and this kid accosted me on the street and said, "How dare you? How could you possibly defile the memory of these women? You're taking my beloved movie and monkeying with it." And I thought he was kidding initially because I hadn't written a note yet. I thought, well, that's not a very auspicious beginning. They hate you before you even start. But I actually managed to win him over. He's since seen the show on and off Broadway many times.
What about the surviving Maisel brother?
Albert Maisel's. David passed away in the 80s. Albert is very much alive, and he's about 80 years old and has more energy than all of us put together. He's been a tremendous supporter and cheerleader for the project, and he cautioned us, Doug Wright, Michael Corey, and I, very early on in the writing. He said, "You know, you guys, it's ultimately a love story between two women, And rather than make it one-sided, we were looking to make a complex portrayal. One is not the villain and one is not the victim. It's more complicated than that.
And that's the way it comes across as a love story between two women. It's the reason that Edie seems to always be dissuading possible suitors. She doesn't want to leave her mother.
Yeah, that's her first devotion, I believe. She's very loyal to her mother.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from people who've talked to you about it? Do you get the feeling that most of them have seen the film?
No, they haven't really. Sometimes they do it backwards. They see the show first, and then they see the documentary afterwards, and sometimes it's the reverse. But overall, I think the experience is sort of a transformational one. It's almost like a spiritual experience that people have. It's quite something.
Well, that only works when a play is effective.
If you
do it poorly, there's no transformation at all. How did you wind up getting Christine into this?
Well, you know, I'd been a fan of her work on stage, both in straight plays and in musicals, and on screen in movies like Amadeus, and also on television on Saturday Night Live. And I knew that she had so many different colors in her repertoire that what enticed me was the possibility of creating a bravura role that would actually allow you to see all those colors, not in a career, but in an evening.
Well, little Edie once said that she didn't want anyone playing her. Did you know that?
But I understand that she knew about the musical, right, Scott?
She did.
She was very excited about it.
I mean, the quote you're referring to is there apparently in the 70s there was interest in doing a film of the Beatles, and they wanted Julie Christie to play her. And she said, oh, Julie Christie could never play me.
I would be honored to have Julie Christie play me.
Well, hello, me too. Little Edie did, Albert Maysles did inform her of the musical's existence before she passed away in 2002, and she was thrilled at the idea of it, and I'm very hopeful.
And she wrote a note about it, didn't she?
She did, and, you know, apparently when she first saw the documentary in the 70s, she said, well, I like it, but I really wish there was more singing and dancing. So I feel that kind of posthumously we've made a restitution and given her just that, more singing and dancing.
The first act of the show is set in 1941, obviously before the documentary was set. Does that give you more freedom in playing Edith?
I don't know if it hits more freedom. It just gives me a different aspect of it, because Act 1 is really sort of more out of my imagination. Mm-hmm. Act 2 is informed by the documentary.
And there's no way you could have... Often actors say, I didn't want to see the other thing because I felt I'd be influenced. There's no way you could do that with something like this.
No, there is no way I could have done it with this one. And plus, I was a big fan before we even started the musical. So when they called and asked me to do it, I just was so excited because I was completely obsessed by the documentary. I think just from an actor's point of view, just, you know, watching those women, it just was just endlessly, endlessly fascinating. But it's really not it's not harder or easier. It's just different doing Big Edie out of my imagination and doing Little Edie that's informed by the documentary.
I mean, I think also that the fact that, you know, if it was an actress playing Joan of Arc, you wouldn't want to see her take on Joan of Arc. You'd want to come up with your own Joan of Arc. But because Edie and Edith were both real women, mm-hmm, and the fact that it's documentary, you can't get more true than their own celluloid versions of themselves.
So exactly.
On the other hand, you can't do a Rich Little version. You have to somehow find...
That's true.
You have to find her in you.
Yeah, that's true.
In the first part, the family seems to be doing relatively well. And Joe Kennedy Jr. is part of the story, John F. Kennedy's older brother. Who wound up dying in World War II.
Right, he was in a mission over the Atlantic, and his plane exploded before it reached its destination, which I assume was a secret mission to Germany, the plane exploded and he was killed. He was the one being groomed by Joe Sr. for the presidency. He was the favored child, the firstborn son, and it was only after his death that John Kennedy was forced into assuming that mantle. We were in the writing, we were very attracted to the historical near miss of the Bouviers and the Kennedys, not the story that we all know with Jackie and John, but the story less known of Edie and Joe. They were allegedly engaged. We've taken a bit of historical license in imagining an engagement party, but you do see a young Jackie Bouvier and her younger sister Lee as children. And so we were fascinated at a scene that would have a Jackie Bouvier interacting with her brother-in-law, not to be Joe Kennedy.
Well, Christine, you knew what Big Edie would turn into based on the documentary. Did you work backwards from there?
No, not really.
Did you do research other than the documentary? Were there newspaper articles, diaries?
Yeah, there was. When we were doing the workshop at Sundance, we were given a lot of material to read that was quite fascinating. But I don't know. I think it's just, well, that's acting. You know, that's all I can say about it. It doesn't really, I mean, I think certainly just that staunch character that Big Edie was, and just so formidable and strong, I think that informed my way of playing it in Act One.
But then you also have to work with Mary Louise Wilson, because she then plays the older version of mm-hmm. who you are, and we have mm-hmm. to believe that's the same
mm-hmm.
person.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So was that something the two of you had to work out in developing it?
No,
because it does seem amazing. We believe it.
Yeah,
never doubt it for a moment.
I think it's just intuitively. It just worked out that way.
Do you think that the music provides some of that continuity?
I think so, and you know, we designed the musical very specifically so that it would resonate for people who were unfamiliar with the documentary, and I think that through music and through the characters of those women, people seem to see. Even though they were American royalty and in extreme situations, I think audiences are seeing elements of their own lives in what's happening on stage. The mother-daughter relationship is so complex. And I think I heard it at a matinee the other day. One woman said to another, you know, she reminded me of your mother. And I thought that was just great, that even though, you know, obviously this woman's mother wasn't eating, you know, pate and thinking it was cat food or vice versa. But nevertheless, they're the universal. But yes, music, I mean, it's in the first act, I really tried to consciously evoke a sound of the 40s. There's some swing. There's some ballads of a 1940s style. And then in the 70s, I also tried to evoke in the second act a very different sound.
And you worked in collaboration with Doug Wright, who wrote some brilliant lyrics.
Doug actually wrote the script,
the book.
Which is also brilliant, but no problem. But Michael Corey wrote the exceptional lyrics. I think he's mm-hmm. just the best lyricist working today.
Mm-hmm. My guests are Scott Frankel, who composed the score for Grey Gardens, which is now playing at the Walter Kerr Theater at 219 West 48th Street, and Christine Ebersole, who is one of the stars. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Let's, when we come back, I think we'll be playing Christine. Oh, we're going to play now you singing Will You?
When lilacs return in spring, will you? When larks in the meadow sing, will you? When clouds of a summer storm dissolve and starlight shimmers,
Christine Ebersole singing one of the songs from Grey Gardens, which is now at the Walter Kerr Theater at 219 West 48th Street. She's here along with Scott Frankel, who wrote the score. 20 songs, although there have been some changes since it was first produced. But one of the things that becomes immediately apparent is that these are songs of the sort that we associate with the old Broadway, songs with real melodies, songs that we might actually remember. Was it your intention to write a kind of an old-fashioned musical, more like Gypsy than like Assassins?
It's hard for, I'm 43 years old. It's hard for writers my age and younger not to be kind of overwhelmed by the shadow of Stephen Sondheim. And I really tried in this show to both assimilate the influences that he's brought to the form, but also to harken back to shows like Gypsy and like Rodgers and Hammerstein, and really not be afraid of a melodic score, of a tuneful soul score. I also thought it was very true to those women, the fact that they loved American popular music, the songs of Jerome Kern and Cole Porter and George Gershwin, and I really tried to evoke a lot of those sounds, particularly in the first act.
Although a lot of the lyrics are incredibly clever, a la Stephen Sondheim. Some of the rhymes are just...
Yeah.
It must be a lot of fun singing songs like that.
Well, I can just safely say I'm having the time of my life.
Did you write these songs with Christine in mind?
You know, some of the score was already written by the time Christine and Mary Louise joined our first workshop, but I'm happy to say that a lot of the songs were written for Christine, the ballads in the second act, Around the World and Another Winter in a Summer Town, both written for her directly.
So, Christine, that must be a fabulous experience, knowing that these things were written for you, a part written with you in mind, songs written with you in mind.
I keep pinching myself every day because, really, people go an entire lifetime and never get to experience something like this. And I just can't believe it. It's so satisfying because it just feels like an accumulation of a lifetime's work that's being able to be recognized and being able to be cherished and shared with an audience in this beautiful way. I just feel like I'm in such a great work of art, and I'm just so honored to be a part of it.
How much of it has changed in its various productions? It was Sundance first,
right? We
then Playwrights Horizons.
Correct. We had a developmental arc that started at Sundance, which, in addition to its more famous film program as a lab, also has a theater lab. And then we did a workshop, and then a full production of Playwrights Horizons in the spring. We learned a lot, and there are also there's the adage that you never really finish musicals; you just open them. And that, in fact, proved to be the case. The fact that we didn't have an out-of-town tryout, Playwrights Horizons ended up being our out-of-town, in-town tryout.
And then you changed it. New York Magazine said that they felt that the show had definitely been improved. It had been tightened up in the in the move from one to the other. Usually what happens is people have to adjust to working on a bigger stage because the off-Broadway stages are usually a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. But you actually decided to rethink some of this and added some songs?
We did. We actually changed a lot of the material. We cut to 5 songs and replaced them with 3 new songs, and there were a lot of text changes, script changes. There were also some casting changes, all in the effort to really hone the storytelling, to make sure we were being lean and clear and powerful in our storytelling of this mother-daughter relationship. And so it was amazing. Our producers have been fantastic, and they actually allowed us the opportunity to go in and rewrite, which is a luxury.
Well, did you gain a different perspective on the characters you played during your time off?
No, I think just with the changes that we've made, it's just deepened the experience and made it more powerful.
But I'm sure you've thought about the psychology of these people. What kept little Edie at Grey Gardens?
Well, I just, coming from my perspective of playing, my goal really is to serve the characters and to be compassionate towards them. And I think it's, for me, a mystery and will remain a mystery why they ended up staying at Grey Gardens. Was Edie crazy? Or was she just a nonconformist? I mean, those kind of things, I don't really want to pass judgment on it because then I think that is reflected in the way I portray it.
Well, little Edie's sense of fashion and her odd ensembles inspired, as I understand it, 2 fashion shoots in the 1990s. One in a Harper's Bazaar shoot in 1998 and another in an Italian Vogue in 1999. And since we were talking about costume, do you see her odd combinations of clothes as some kind of expression of her character,
creativity? I do, because I think it's her nonconformity and her sense of style, but her nonconformity in that style that influences fashion designers, because it's that sort of independence, you know, that you want to stand out and you want to sort of be in the forefront. And I think Edie sort of led the way.
And they're almost beautiful in their oddness.
I agree. I mean, I think that they're so startling, the way she creatively combines scarves and snoods and skirts, and you get this hodgepodge of an ensemble that somehow is put together thrillingly. And I do think uh-huh. she used it as her armor in fighting the battle against the way mm-hmm. people thought she should behave, the way East uh-huh. Hampton thought the ladies should live, and the way her family expected her to live.
And they lived in that house another 6 years after the show ends. Why did they finally leave? Did Edith die?
Big Edie died 2 years, I believe, wasn't it, Scott?
She died in 1977, mm-hmm. and little Edie finally sold the house at that point. It was purchased by the editor of the Washington Post, Ben Bradley, and his wife, Sally Quinn, who own it to this day. It was beautifully restored, and we've had the great fortune of actually visiting it several times.
Although they say that when it rains, there's a faint smell of cat urine in the house, and cats are in the cast.
Well, what could be more romantic than that?
After all those years, I guess. The house changes from the first act to the second act, and it kind of reflects what's happening.
Absolutely. I mean, I read a review, actually, an insightful one, which pointed out it's perhaps the first musical in which the house is the main character and is the titular character. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in the first act, we see the house and the women and the nation in a very pristine, optimistic place. And then in the 70s, we see the house, like the women, like the nation, in a much more complicated, conflicted, decaying place.
Because it's such a beautiful house in the first act.
Mm. Which is the way it looks today.
Why do you think this story has such a resonance for so many people? Is it because of the nonconformity?
Oh, there's so many levels of it. But I think part of it is because, you know, it's almost like the way you feel when you talk about the Titanic. You think, well, how could the Titanic have sunk? Because the Astors were on it. Here are these beautiful, beautiful, intelligent women born to the manor.
And talented.
And talented, but had everything going for them. And to see them living in garbage, it's just impossible. You can't believe it. You think, well, how could that happen? They're rich. How could that happen to them? It's just endlessly fascinating.
But as you said earlier, it's also a love story. It's a love story where they're clearly attached to each other, and yet they can be really nasty to each other, and we understand that kind of love
story. I think that that those intimate relationships, particularly family relationships, have the capacity for being the ugliest and inflicting mm-hmm. the most wounds, but mm-hmm. Hopefully, ideally, also applying the salves and the bandages.
Mm-hmm. Is this an open run?
Yes.
Happily so.
Is that something you like to do, Christine? Most people resist doing it because there are these other projects that they'd like to be involved with somewhere down the line.
Well, that is true, and that has been true for me in the past. There are certain projects, very few, that you get a hold of where you don't want it to end because it's a never-ending practice and nuance, and that the text allows that to happen. A lot of parts you end up mining in the first preview and you can't wait until your contract is over. But this is certainly the case where it's never-ending nuance. It's like a wine that is,
Well, I said to you today, I said, I don't know what you're going to do after this. I mean, but then I thought maybe King Lear might be just a little bit of a challenge for you. But I think it'd be hard to go. It'd be like
What do you do after this?
Because you play two complex characters, you get to sing a lot of beautiful songs, and in two different voices on top of it all.
Yes, and the text is so rich. The music and the lyrics and the text is so rich and just so endless in its depth that, you know, you can always Every night you find something new.
Although you can take some of these costumes and adapt them to Lear, I think. We want to thank you both so much for being
thank
with
you.
Us.
It was
Christine Ebersole, Scott Frankel, we're talking about Grey Gardens, now at the Walter Kerr Theater at 219 West 48th Street. You can check out our website for more information on it.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Gore Vidal talks about his life and writing with his latest memoir. And then James Beard Award-winning cookbook writer Claudia Roden shares some recipes from Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. Plus, Susan Laurie Parks tells us about writing a new play every single day for an entire year. And this week's Please Explain is all about vegetarianism. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Samantha Morgenstern and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host, and I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopez Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.